Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome back to another edition of BOA Audio. It's kind of, it's dreary tonight. Stormy weather here in Boston, and I was having some technical problems earlier, so hopefully we don't have any going further, but that's what kind of things happen on. It's 6-6-6-6-17. We kind of planned all this out because our guest is the incomparable icon of cryptozoology and one of the premier researchers of the oddities of the Twilight language. I'm not sure how much we'll get into that tonight, but we've talked about it in the past on the show. And, of course, he is the man behind the proprietor of the International Cryptozoology Museum, which is an absolutely fantastic place. And by now I'm sure you've heard about it. It is just amazing, and we're going to be talking about that tonight, too. Of course, I am talking about the incomparable Loren Coleman. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Well, it's great to be here, Tim, and hopefully I'll live up to all of those, whatever we want to call them, because I've been working so hard. I'm so tired. I'm going to be able to just barely get through this 2 hours and 3 hours or 4 hours, whatever it is with you.
I have you down for a couple. I hope they're good. All right. Well, he's the man, folks. You all know that. And, he's behind the International Cryptozoology Museum. Let's start with that because that's your baby. I know you really want to talk about that because it's absolutely awesome. And I'm a little hurt. Somebody asked you on Twitter the other day, like, if I had been there, you thought I hadn't. I've been there twice. I was there when the first week it opened, the very first place. I have the grand opening week shirt or something still. I don't think it would fit me. I'm not sure if it would fit, but.
Well, the person asked me, and I think it must have been like 2 a.m. in the morning, so my mind was kind of foggy. So, and you just recently came there with George Sippel.
Yeah.
Detroit Tigers writer. So that was a great visit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just say, the museum has been in existence since 2003. I was trying to do my math because in 2009, we moved downtown and we just last year moved to the new building that we bought out on Thompson's Point. And mm-hmm. Thompson's Point is a new entertainment venue where there's a brewery next door to us, and then next door to that, there's a winery. On the other side, there's a distillery.
Yeah.
There's going to be and there's outdoor concerts there, and there's going to be a hotel and a children's museum. So it's the new in place for Portland. So it's great to get on the ground floor last year, and so we're kind of getting used to being there because it's just amazing.
Go ahead.
I mean, just number of people finding us is just increased tremendously.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome. I mean, I'm just so happy for you because I remember, like I said, when it first opened, it was like in the back of a bookstore, and it's just exploded. It's really exploded into this real destination. That's probably the best way to put it. I mean, people from all over the world come to check this place out, and I'm glad that it's got this awesome new location that's befitting, its reputation. So couldn't be happy.
Right.
And I loved my visit there, and I'm hoping to come up there. How's this for a segue? I'm hoping to come up there for Labor Day weekend for the big conference. Tell us about
that. Oh, good. Yeah, that would be good. Well, just we already sort of planned, if you build it, they will come. And that really did happen. And so part of that is we've started having annual conferences. Last year we did it in St. Augustine, Florida.
Yeah.
That worked out pretty well, but we wanted to make the first conference really a big deal. And, you know, it was expensive, and we never made any money, but we're nonprofit, so, you know, we got some nice donors, and that was good. Well, this year we wanted to do it in New England, and what better place to do it than right in Portland?
Yeah.
So it's going to be at the hotel that's literally 1/10 of a mile from the museum, so that we can actually use the museum to give tours there. We're going to have a chainsaw demonstration of making a Bigfoot, you know, with a tree log. And different things like that. But the conference is going to be all day on Sunday, the 3rd of September. So people can have days to travel in, and they can have days to leave, you know, the Monday of Labor Day.
Yeah.
So it just is kind of a good time. And then a lot of students go back to school. A lot of people really kind of get back into their work mindset, and they're not vacationing anymore. But we're going to have different people talking about different things. You know, some of them is going to be like on Ape Canyon. Is there a supernatural part of Ape Canyon? We're definitely a zoological, biological-based museum, but we have to be open to all kinds of explanations and theories because people want to talk about it. Bruce Champlain, who's never given a – he's done a lot of writing, and he's done a lot of researching on lake monster types. He's never really given a conference presentation, so I think that's a coup to have somebody that's been doing things in the field for so long. And then just all kinds of different people. You know, I can go over and over it, but people can, through our website, they can find the link. And we're going to have all-day presentations. And then at night, we're going to have the East Coast premiere of Seth Breedlove's new movie, The Mothman of Point Pleasant.
Ah, nice.
I think that'll be cool. There's also a couple of film surprises that I'm not going to even talk about online.
Yeah.
You know, something from Europe and something from someplace else. Just kind of use that last evening session. We're not sure if we're going to get popcorn yet, but we're going to make it fun. And and then the next day, of course, with the chainsaw chainsaw demonstration for those people who want to hang around. And at the same time that's happening, I didn't even know it until this week, but Thompson's Point is going to have an expressive dance presentation that's going to be going on at the same time.
Interesting.
We're going to have like 10 food trucks, so it's going to be one of those kind of outdoor venues that happen at Thompson's Point sort of without anybody really knowing about it. We have a lot of concerts like Elvis Costello and stuff coming, but no concerts that weekend, but it's going to be dance and chainsawing and Bigfoot and all kinds of things like that.
Nice, nice. Wow. Well, I talk to a lot of people all the time, and all the time, because I'm from here, and I always mention the museum and how they should come and check it out. And so many people are always like, oh, I really got to go. I really want to see it. I really, you know, I'm definitely going to go there someday. Folks, go that weekend. That's the perfect time to go. I really do talk to a lot of people, and they say, oh, I really want to go there. I really want to go there. It's like,
a lot of people say it's on my bucket list. I just have never made it there. Well, that's why we even started extending our hours on Fridays and Saturday nights and afternoons, because people were saying, well, we went by and it's closed. Well, that's no excuse anymore. Even that weekend, we're going to extend hours into the 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock hour, because there's going to be so many people around. And even the Sea Dogs are in town, so maybe some people will want to go to the Sea Dogs game too.
Well, I'm going to do my damn best to be up there, I promise. So,
good.
I'd like to make it an annual thing that I get up there, because it's only a couple hours for me, but, you know, you got to find somebody to go with you, so that's half the trouble for a creep
I'm
like me.
I'm already giving out media credentials, and you certainly earned that.
Well, thank you very much, yeah.
So
what's exciting, we have the website here, or let me see. You know it, I'm sure.
CryptoZoologyMuseum.com.
There you go. And that has all the info. But like I was saying,
yeah, it has
so many people say they want to come and check it out. So this is the time. They're rolling out the red carpet for you folks. So go up there and do it.
Thanks, Tim.
And I, you know something? I know a few people around here, so I'll know. I'll have somebody. I'll be like, we're going. That's it. Enough talk about it, man. We're going to go. So.
And we do have tickets on sale, and they change to a little bit higher price after July 15th. So we really encourage people because they are actually selling. I mean, we're not doing that. You know, if you've got to buy them today, they'll all be gone. But certainly they are selling pretty rapidly.
Well, pick them up, folks. Definitely, definitely. Now we'll get into the esoteric talk here because I know people want to hear that. I'm interested in. I emailed you today about this because I've been following the news a lot in the last year, as you know. So I've kind of become a news hound in this field, and I'm really interested in sort of the reemergence of the Tasmanian tiger over the last year. And now, which is culminating, I guess you could say, with this search, this 50-plus game camera search that's being conducted by an Australian university in the hinterlands of Australia, where the Tasmanian tiger may lurk. So, what are your thoughts on this? Give me the breakdown. You're the expert. I mean, should I saw that also there's this mathematical model that's like there's almost no chance it's still around, but I don't trust that. I'm pulling for the underdog here.
Well, this I think his name is Professor Lawrence.
Yeah.
And he's going to do trail cams. And I read one thing that he's interested in really looking in the northern part of Tasmania, where we're pretty sure most of us have been. You know, there's different reports that come in from Tasmania, but there's been real negative sort of feeling about Tasmania for a long time. There's really an overuse of the land. There's too many trees are being cut down. And once you start seeing the habitat of these animals disappearing, it's almost nostalgia to go looking for it in the same old place. What I've been getting from a lot of my Australian friends and everybody else in that end of the world, that Western Australia is much better territory because there's still a lot of trees and wilderness areas, and there has been over 400 sightings in the Western Australian area, and that probably will be the better places. So I'm hoping Lawrence, Professor Lawrence, really branches out if he gets enough funding, and that's always the key. How much funding, you know, is it going to be more than just a weekend jaunt, or is it going to be able to sustain something for a few months, because that's where you'll find the animals. And you got to get friendly with the locals, because the locals don't care. They, you know, a lot of them feel that the tiger's out there, we don't care if you come and look for it or not. And that recent movie, remember the William Dafoe movie a few years ago?
Yeah.
It really was about that. The locals know the things out there, and these people from away that come in and want to either shoot it or film it or whatever really are not treated too much friendly.
Yeah.
Now my baseline sort of secret notion here is that I think the historical range of the thylacine extends all the way to New Guinea, and New Guinea is still the place where we're finding new species and new animals.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if the thylacine won't eventually someday be found in New Guinea, and everybody's looking in the wrong place.
Well, just
New Guinea's very dangerous, but you know, still, it could be there.
Yeah. Well, just to clear this up, he's actually going to be doing the expedition on the Cape York Peninsula, which is like the tip of northern Australia.
Right. Right. Yes.
Rather than Tasmania. So I don't know. I'm excited, though. I mean, it's good that there's an academic interest to try this. I mean, I think if they somehow get a picture of the thylacine, that could change everything in a lot of ways, I hope, because then maybe a bunch of American universities will be like, hey, let's get out there with game cameras and get Bigfoot.
Yeah, well, you know, there just was a new exposure of a photograph that went around in 2015. It turned out was a a very ancient, you know, a 1930s photograph that somebody had superimposed on a more recent landscape.
I saw that, yeah. I
think that I still would have a problem with he. All he came back with was, you know, trail cam or a photograph, because we really need DNA. We, you know, and it doesn't have to be DNA from a dead body. It can be a DNA from the saliva that a thylacine would leave on a prey animal.
Mm, yeah.
And so there's different ways to get the DNA, and we definitely have enough bodies. We have the DNA of the thylacine, so hopefully that he'll get something like that, and we won't have a kind of a gray area, almost like an episode of Finding the Thylacine or something.
Yeah.
Where, you know, put the trail cams out every night. He checks them, and there's nothing there. Because I'm sure there's going to be a documentary made of this.
He said two channels are trying to film for it. And I think, hey, if he gets a picture, I think it'll be better than just some random picture that shows up online. At least then he'll probably be able to go back there maybe and do more, God knows what. But it's like, as sad as it is, it's like the people weigh evidence differently. So if him and the project comes back with a picture, it's like, I don't think a lot of people are going to say it's doctored. I mean, some people will, but it's like, why would this guy do that? That's crazy.
Right. No, not so much doctor, but just that kind of ungray. Oh well, he got the eyes and the shape of the
nose
there,
yeah.
but he didn't get it all. So maybe we do. The skepticism in this field is extremely high.
Right. Exactly. I was thinking about that today, actually, because it's like if he did get the picture, your first instinct is to be like, it's alive. But then it's like you got to prove it. Like the picture just says, hey, you know, we're probably right, but we gotta really drill down and get it. You know.
Yeah. Well, and like tonight on Animal Planet, I was flipping the channels and I saw that there was a documentary on the thylacine, these two people going out looking for the thylacine. And I waited all the way to the end to see that it was done in 2015. And of course, as I was watching the whole thing, it was like, this is day 11 and they haven't seen it. So they're going to stay one more night because this could be the night that they actually take a photograph of it. And I was thinking, yeah, we would have already heard about this.
Right, yeah.
So if this guy, you know, Professor Lawrence, signs with a documentary film company, we're not going to hear about it for 6 months after he gets back. So hopefully.
I thought about that. Yeah, one would assume, because then he'd want to roll it out in some peer-reviewed paper in a journal somewhere.
Right.
And, you know, it's like, the money and shit.
The production company wouldn't want him to come back and have a news conference, and you know, they want to build up the suspense in their film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll hear about it like in November around sweeps. That's probably when we'll know
if that's when sweeps is in Australia.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, whenever November sweeps is. But what do you make of like how this Tasmanian tiger's like become the new it thing in the last like year? Have you noticed it, or am I just seeing like every blue car after I buy a blue car kind of thing?
Yeah, I definitely think it's a reflective factor for you because, you know, Bigfoot is still very hot in some corners, and then, you know, other different things. I think it's just, it's one of those things that it's a 9-day wonder. Everybody's talking, or at least some people are talking about the thylacine, and everybody is so tired of politics. They're looking for something exciting from the animal world.
Humans have disappointed us so badly.
Absolutely. So I've been noticing that every time there's and actually I wrote the other day about how the overuse of the word breaking news.
Oh, God, it's awful.
On the channels. So if you get a story about a Black Panther in Georgia, which just came out a couple of days ago, everybody's going to talk about a Black Panther sightings in the South for a while because they're hoping that it will get everybody off the trend of talking about, you know, Russia or some recent, you know, stabbing at Notre Dame or something. So
exactly.
It's just amazing how people are absolutely on such adrenaline highs that they now are doing that with cryptozoology.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a great segue to The other thing that's really got my attention over the last year, and this is the creepy clowns. Now, I know you think this is something that's come along, that's sort of like become a phenomenon. So it's not like I'm not imagining this, I hope. What do you make of the creepy clown explosion and how they're now kind of coming back? I think it's like seasonal in a sense. Like, it's getting warmer out, people are going to be outside more, and you're going to see more of these idiots doing stuff.
Well, I definitely would have to agree that the media is the source of what becomes important on the media. It's, you know, it's a self-reinforcing cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So, 1981, I coined the word phantom clowns because started in the Boston area for me, and then it was, remember, 1981, you have to really think back. There was no internet. There was no emails.
Right.
There were only letters, and there wasn't even very good photocopy machines. There was thermal fax. There was all kinds of different things like that. So for myself, as a 40 and as one that investigated unknown phenomena, I noticed this trend in Providence. I noticed it in Cambridge, in, you know, Roxbury, and in Boston, that the children were saying that they were seeing these clowns that got close to them but never captured them.
Right.
They were riding in vans. There were stories about them not wearing any pants. They only had clown costumes from the waist up, but they were in vans. So how people saw that, I never could figure that out. But
yeah.
So, and then so what I did is I wrote all of my friends across the country. I wrote them letters and I said, please send me clippings if you get any reports of clowns. And before I knew it, I started hearing from Kansas City, from Omaha, you know, Chicago. I mean, it started coming to me that there was actually a national phenomena going on, that nobody in any of the national wire services was doing that. So, you know, all of a sudden, let's go forward until last year. What happened last year was very much a repeat of that, except add the internet, add emails. And so what occurred was in the Carolinas, you started having children in schools or in housing projects or whatever, seeing these clowns, saying that they were trying to lure them into the woods. And then none of the adults saw them. None of the police people could capture them. And then it started jumping to Georgia, jumping to Arkansas, jumping to Louisville. And the phantom clowns, and I even wrote an article or blog about the classification, because phantom clowns is a very specific, they're not a, you know, creepy clown came later last year, but they were first and foremost phantom clowns. But then what occurred was people started imitating these clowns, or what I call stalking clowns, where actual real people would put on outfits and they'd get photographs. They'd go close to people. They'd appear on streets with balloons. They'd chase people on bridges. And those started showing up. And it just exploded around the world. And, of course, England gave us a whole different version of clowns called killer clowns, which became more violent. These were more violent reports of clowns. And so then they disappeared. They disappeared almost immediately after Halloween last year.
Mm-hmm.
It went from having four or five reports in the news to zip, zero. But then what's occurred this year is the phantom clowns haven't come back. The stalking clowns haven't come back. What we're actually getting back are killer clowns, including an actual first case. And this was out in Denver, of a man who had knives or some kind of
the Freddy Krueger glove.
Right, exactly. And he killed somebody at a location in Denver. And then there's been two or three other incidents where people have got hurt. and it's a much more violent situation. And, you know, there's a little bit of the Joker in it, a little bit of the, you know, kind of It is coming back, the movie. It is being rebooted.
Yeah.
So people are throwing all of that into all of the stories. And luckily it's not spreading fast, and there's, I've only been able to document, I think, 4 cases. It's not like the, I mean, literally it must have been 150 cases.
Yeah,
it was from
crazy
last year.
Yeah.
It was,
I mean, it was a national, international phenomenon, but like people were, it was all over the news and everything. It was crazy. It was absolutely crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely did not seek any media interviews, but because I'd done that work in 1981, Rolling Stone, you know, New York papers, all of these people just showed up out of the woodwork to interview me about the Phantom Clown phenomenon. It was the most publicity I've ever got about clowns. And I hadn't even
I should hope so.
Yeah. But it was just, and, you know, good old Ben Radford's the one that wrote a book about it last year. And he, you know, he got a few interviews, but I think I got more than him.
There you go.
He was disappointed.
Yeah. Well, who likes a party pooper when it comes to clowns?
Right. So we'll see where that goes. I think I just noticing the news all the time now, people are just not staying with the clowns for very long.
Yeah,
they're going to
go
on to something else. Yeah,
it's now it just seems like unhinged people are, or it's like not even.
Oh yeah,
it's
yeah,
moved on from it. Like the people, the young, you know, teenagers who think it's funny to just like crazy people essentially. It's out of the bottom of the barrel, I guess. But, yeah, it's interesting how you mentioned the sort of the classification. Yeah, so you're saying kind of like the Phantom Clowns is sort of like the more ephemeral, elusive sort of like people see them and then they're gone. And then the –
Yeah, there's absolutely no evidence other than the sightings.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Then the stalking clowns are just normal people that are taking advantage of the clown phenomenon. And then the killer clowns
– Or the violent
ones. I mean,
there
were people – getting bats and different things like that in England last year, then it's jumped to really violence. But I really think that the piece of news that every news organization is waiting for is the most recent terrorist attack. And so that's the Phantom Clowns of this year. It's, you know, where's the bomb or where's the car ramming somebody or where's the stabbing going in on what church? And that seems to be, the media is much more interested in that than waiting around for clown stories.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, absolutely. You hope that this sort of string of things, it's already sort of becoming a string of things, so you worry that it's, like, leading to something, you know, escalating. It's very nerve-wracking, you know. And it is kind of like what I said about the clowns, too, in a way, where it really is like the warmer weather. That's when these bad things happen. You don't see a lot of clowns out there. You don't see as many, like, of these crazy events, it seems. What do you make, actually, of the... Did you see this thing that was floating around that all these events seem to happen with a 22 in it or something like that? Did you see that meme that went around?
Yeah, I saw that meme. It's really very pretty bad research. I mean, you can... It is the reflective... And I saw a skeptical article about it very quickly after that. I think even Snoop, you know, that he actually... He came out and said, you can look at a series of dates for the terrorists and everybody will look at the 22s, but I mean, 11s come up or 7-7 or, you know, not too many 6-6s, but just, you know, it just gets in people's head. And I don't think there's really too much to the 22.
All right. That's good to know.
But I do think, I mean, I wrote in my Copycat Effect book, which came out in 2004, I wrote in depth in there and said that terrorists love the attention and the media is reinforcing it. It's a phenomenon that is driven by the media for the media.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. And that's hasn't changed as far as now what the electronic media and the cable networks and cable news networks, just that's why this whole the useless phrase breaking news now just means nothing. And it just, they need something every day so they can put breaking news underneath the title of the little scroll. It's worthless.
Yeah, well, I noticed, like, CNN, they do it on the hour, every hour, when they start the next show or whatever, and then they just tell you what the news is, and it's like, it's not breaking news. You talked about it for the whole last hour, like.
Yeah, but it's on Fox, and it's on MSNBC, too. And I was thinking to myself today, well, what if there's a presidential assassination? Are they going to put double breaking news?
Exactly. How do you know? Yeah, exactly. They've completely obliterated the meaning of breaking news. So how will we even know?
Right.
It's weird.
But anyway, back to cryptozoology.
Yeah.
Definitely there are some breaking news, like the discovery that there's really four species of flying squirrel in America. That they actually, one of them had been hiding in plain sight. They had classified the northern flying squirrel as one species, and very, very interestingly, the Humboldt flying squirrel exists in the Pacific Northwest. It's a very distinctive flying squirrel, and I think those kinds of breaking news, where we find new animals and new discoveries like that, really impact on the whole field. Because as I was talking to some people about that, you look at the range of that new squirrel, and exactly it matches in the Pacific Northwest where the best Bigfoot reports come from.
Really?
There's an ecosystem there of, redwoods and sequoias and wilderness areas where that squirrel has survived and is biologically DNA isolated from the whole other squirrels, flying squirrels that are around it. And so there must be something going on that species feels extremely, like on an island, a DNA island.
Hmm.
And so that, I've always said, a lot of people say, there's Bigfoot in Rhode Island or, in the Berkshires of Massachusetts. That's fine and good. I really see that as a shadow Bigfoot, the sociology of Bigfoot, that there's Bigfoot seen in every state. And,
and it
has a lot to do with everybody wants to see a Bigfoot. Everybody hears things in the woods, but absolutely the best stories, the best native stories, the best evidence comes from the Pacific Northwest. And so that's where I think we're going to find Bigfoot. And all of the rest of this is entertaining, interesting, and worth pursuing. But it doesn't mean you should get frustrated when you, kick around in the mountains of Western Massachusetts and all you find are ticks on your legs.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, man, that's the last thing you want to find.
Yeah.
Like the very last thing, yikes.
Right.
Interesting. So I'm interested. I'm antsy, I've been in this for a long time. You've been in this like four times as long as I have. I don't know how you can handle it any longer. I want this Bigfoot, man. I've had enough. I want this mystery solved.
Well, that's what I call the celebrity cryptids. The Loch Ness Monster, the sea serpents, the Yeti, and the Bigfoot. Everybody, that's the holy grail for some people, and they just feel totally frustrated all the time and antsy because they can't find those. I'm absolutely satisfied. 3 years ago, 4 years ago, we found a whole new species of tapir, the little prehensile nose creature in Brazil.
Yeah.
We find new monkeys that are quite startling. You find a new species of bird in Central Park in New York City, or you find a new turtle in the river in Mississippi, or a giant king crayfish in Tennessee. I'm excited by those discoveries all the time because it shows to me that right here in our midst, there's new animals, and you don't have to go all the way to the Himalayas to look for the abominable snowman every day. You can really just, and support biologists and wildlife people and university, individuals who are doing this groundbreaking work. So I'm excited, and I love all of that stuff every day.
Well, that's good. So you're Yeah, you're okay with the Bigfoot being out there. Not, I just, you know, I just feel like I wish I had. If I ever like won the lottery, that would be like my main thing. I'd be like, I forget the name of the guy. I'm sure you know, like the super, you know, who was the super rich like industrialist or whatever that was that sort of like funded a lot of Bigfoot research or something.
Oh, Tom Slick.
Yeah, that's
Tom
what
Page,
I would turn
yeah.
into Tom Slick. You know, yeah. That's how much I'm after the Bigfoot. But what we talked about this last time you were on, it's interesting to talk about. We had Adam Davies on a few weeks ago, and he kind of touched on this too. This, and you, like I said, you mentioned it a couple of years ago when we talked, this this new trend of like Bigfoot habituation stories and stuff like that. Is that still going on, or is that kind of like still is it sort of like lessening since we last talked?
Oh no, it's getting worse. It's
yeah.
getting much worse. Yeah, there's whole groups of people, and I won't mention any names because you know everybody has a right to be an idiot. So
yeah.
But there's one guy that everybody is hating on out west, and he's saying things like he saved a group of Bigfoot that had come down on UFOs, and
oh,
he put them back up in the woods of the Pacific Northwest, and he's just making such a silly mess of people that had clumped around him almost in a cult-like behavior, and some people that have even been pulled in by this individual, and then he all of a sudden says things like, you know, they're out there, and I'm going to go communicate with them and do all of this other stuff, and it's really become to some people so close to a cult that it's making other people who are just new to Bigfoot thinking, oh my gosh, I can't be involved in this field because so and so has made this, you know, so stupid. So that's what I'm seeing is that it's almost like ufology was.
I was just going to say, sounds like ufology. Like ufology.
Yeah, because if you actually look at the amount of TV programs on TV, I think there's a ground level, almost a foundation of strange shows that are about ghosts. But if you notice in the last 15 years, there's been more and more, almost an explosion of cryptozoological shows. You
yes,
know, like
yes.
Mountain monsters or monsters underground or that are fictionalized. That are fictionalized. They may use the real name of a creature like Mapaguari, but then they say it's in a cave in California, which has never been reported in the literature. So I think that is, to me, a demonstration that popular culture is taking hold of cryptozoology and bypassing the reality of it, whereas you don't hear about UFO shows doing that. You know, UFOs have really been left in the dust.
Mm.
And yet these haunted shows or, you know, collector or ghost hunters or, I mean, there's so many different variations on the haunted shows that seems to have a life of its own and keeps on going.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, UFOs seem antiquated now. It's like they're just kind of, they're just old. They're just old. That's the, I can't know the way to really put it. There's like a dusty old phenomenon. And yeah, it's interesting. I was talking to Marie Jones about this last week. It's like, you must know, how many of these, you probably don't because there's so many, but how many of these Bigfoot shows are on nowadays? Because it's like, I can't even keep up with all these different shows.
Yeah, I mean, it was easily 12, you know, 2 years ago. But then we have to be realistic, too. Like, for instance, Finding Bigfoot is in its last season.
Yeah, that was like, that's like the big daddy. That's like the ghost hunters of Bigfoot.
Right,
stuff.
But before that, there was Unsolved Mysteries. There was, and that would have Bigfoot shows on it.
Right.
So now you have a lot of these fictionalized shows that last 2-3 episodes, and then they crash and burn. And yet, setting where I am here in Maine with a International Cryptozoology Museum, I maybe get in 1 month 5 inquiries from, you know, well, we're thinking about doing a cryptozoology show, and we'd like to call you up and talk to you for 2 hours and have you give us all of your leads and all of your ideas, which is really, and they really do. They really think that I'm going to just be there at their beck and call, but it tells me at least that people are still, you know, trying to get some of these shows greenlit, and they're still trying to produce them. It is interesting to me that there's so many superhero movies and there hasn't been a like number of sort of 1950s sort of monster movies. They just haven't been coming along. So maybe that'll catch up. Maybe that'll be the next trend.
Yeah, well, I heard the Mummy movie, spoiler alert, folks, I heard the Mummy movie has like a cameo of the creature from the Black Lagoon or something, like, to build to another movie. So.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Now half the people in the audience listening are like furiously writing me an email being like, why'd you spoil that, man?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's kind of like being told that you should stay past the credits for a Marvel movie because there's hints about four other things. If people haven't figured that out yet, that there's going to be hints in these movies, then you need to grow up.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking today, too, this is a timely fashion. You may not have anything to say about this, but I should say it so I don't have to just pollute my Facebook with it. But it's like you see all these thought pieces about the Wonder Woman movie, and it's like, oh, what does it mean? What does it mean? It's like, what it means is they should just make an original movie. Like, make a new movie. Don't make us the fourth movie of the same characters we've seen a million times, and people will flock to the movie theater. Even though Wonder Woman's an iconic character, they've done it a million times. Like, they haven't done a movie in ages. There's not really, I don't think, any sociological sort of explanation for anything like that.
Well,
it's pretty simple.
Well, also, Wonder Woman's about women, and they haven't made enough superhero movies about women, you know.
That was
a good thought. Yeah, you mean like you don't want movie number 7 on Wolverine?
Right, exactly.
Well, it is interesting also that it always boggled my mind that Spider-Man, we'd have to see three movies about the creation of Spider-Man again and again and again. But a lot of these movies are killing off their characters so they can bring them back for the next generation, you know, in 13 years when people forgot that they just saw that movie.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, back to the personal level here with me, I've written some 40 books. Of those 40 books, there's only one book that has a movie option on it. It's the story of Tom Slick, the guy that you mentioned, and about how I funded. It's, you know, of all my books, it's the one that's the closest to a biography. So I tell about this rich Texas oil millionaire and how he sponsored the Yeti, expeditions and the Bigfoot expedition. That's been in development hell for like 12 years.
Oh, wow.
And early on, a guy named Nicolas Cage appeared in Variety newspaper saying that he'd more or less bought the rights for my movie and was going to make the Tom Slick movie. Then he went on to the Superman movie. Nicolas Cage never bought the rights to my movie. Somebody else did, and he's still working on it because he's passionate about these things. But I, of course, can't tell any of the audience or you about it, or I would be shot because that's non-disclosure thing. But to me, it says, there's all of these superhero movies that are keep being made, and somebody someday is going to settle down and say, hey, why don't we make the Abominable Snowman movie? Why don't we make a good Bigfoot movie? And they haven't done that yet. And that would be an original story because everybody's just redoing comic books, which I'm not saying anything against DC or Marvel. I like those movies as much as everybody else. But you're right, there's nothing original as far as the storylines and the characters.
Yeah. Now, let me see. We had something else in the notes you were talking to me about. It's interesting. It's just the whole – it's the entertainment world is very repetitive nowadays. It's very, very frustrating. I know I know what I was going to suggest, actually, is if they want to do a show, they like characters and stuff, they should just do a show about you running the museum.
I'm realistic enough. I've been approached several times in my history, and they get to the point and they said, oh my gosh, this guy has white hair and he's such and such age. I don't think that's a good demographic. Let's move on. Let's get a young man and a young woman and you know, make them actors. Oh, you mean like Josh Gates? I mean, Josh Gates is a good guy, and I've been with him and appeared with him and everything. But Josh Gates is an actor who has become a host of these shows.
Yeah.
That's the ones that succeed. And if you really notice, I mean, Adam Davies, for instance, has been on a lot of shows, and I've been on a lot of shows, but most of the time we're there's the expert or the authority or, you know, out on the expedition or please, Lauren, could you walk through those woods again so we can get that shot again?
Yeah.
So I'm very aware of the demographics, and also running a museum is pretty boring.
Yeah.
You know, it's exciting for me, and it's a good legacy. And I just spent, for instance, 90 minutes tonight recurating the Native American cabinet and exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of things that I have to do because I get new material in all the time, and I want to showcase it. But it's not exactly, you know, the museum coming alive at night sort of thing.
Right.
They make things about. But Mysteries at the Museum, for instance, which they've been to our museums 8 times now, it's a very interesting show if you actually concentrate and focus on one item and then build the story around that. That is actually a model that really has worked for that show.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, I was going to say, you know how they would do it is they'd hire like 20-something, you know, a guy and a woman, and they'd say they were married and they were like worked there, and that was right, you know, and you would pop in, you know, at the beginning and the end of the episode and be like, "No, guys," and then, you know, it would be about how they would get into a fight. Some, you know, it would be ridiculous. That's how these shows work, and it's like at the museum.
And then they'd show a couple of customers coming to the desk, and they'd say, "Here, we're buying your book. Would you please sign it?" And I sign it, then I say the joke that I often do, which is, okay, I'm signing it, but I'm going to date it today because, you know, if I die tomorrow, the book will be worth more. And then everybody laughs and they go off into the sunset.
Exactly, yeah. Then they're like, yeah, then they cut back to some fight about how the actress had an argument about groceries or something, yeah.
Right. Because I was recently with Craig Woolheater out in Willow Creek.
Yeah.
It's been a very busy spring. I was actually in Willow Creek because this is the 50th year of Bigfoot. And, you know, the Finding Bigfoot crew was there and Bob Gimlin and Craig Woolheater, he's very jealous of me always inventing words and coining words like, you know, Montauk Monster, Bridgewater Triangle.
Yeah, you're the master of that. I aspire to be like you with that stuff, yeah.
So he said, I'm going to coin a word. Because you always write obituaries, Lauren, I'm going to call them crypto bits. It doesn't work, but, you know, his idea was to crypto bits, yeah.
That sounds like a cereal.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I told him it sounds, because the word bits sort of separates itself, most people wouldn't get the obits part of it, but anyway. So.
Yeah. On the other hand, on the bright side, coming soon to the International Crypto Museum is CryptoBits, the cereal. We'll roll that out at the Labor Day event.
Right. Well, so you must have read my blog lately about serial killers spelled with a C.
Oh, God.
But anyway, that term was actually coined by the FBI.
Serial killer with a C?
Yeah.
What is
because
that?
Because there's lots of... Oh, there's lots of grains involved. There's lots of corn involved, and a lot of the actual serial killer's motif and stuff. So it's very deep, very deep.
Like serial killers, who kind of like maybe lurk in that in the agricultural realm.
As some people say, serial killers in a lot of this Twilight language really revolves around stories. So a lot of the killers really want some story to develop out of it. And if you look at, a lot of people don't understand how I can be interested in the Twilight language and cryptozoology, but a lot of the cryptozoology stories are very deep with stories, like the whole Fred Beck and the Ape Canyon and his interest in spiritualism and a lot of stuff like that. It's not just one thread that runs through these. I went out, I saw this big hairy creature, and I came home and wrote it down. There's usually all of this other personality stuff that surrounds a lot of these stories. So that, when I was in school and in anthropology and zoology, it made a lot of sense and was pure physical creatures. But then I got deeper and deeper into it and saw that to get a master's in psychiatric social work certainly would help, because I was getting a lot of psychology thrown at me by a lot of eyewitnesses.
Yeah.
You know, they were scared. They wanted to talk to me and tell me their stories because they needed to be affirmed that they actually had a sighting. It's very much like that saying about all news is local.
Yeah.
It's very much all of these sightings are about the people.
Oh, absolutely. They're not
having them so that they can be a community of individuals that's trying to prove something. They're really just experiencing on a very personal level, and they're trying to interpret that. And that's why they buy books or go to conferences or join support groups. It's so that they can really feel comfortable in their body and in their mind that they had this extraordinary incident occur to them.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense just from having sort of toiled in the UFO field. You get a lot of that there a lot. So as I can see how it sort of applies across the different spectrums of experience, you know, because very few people seek this stuff out and actually experience it, you know, unless they're like kooky ghost hunters, because they, you know, that's a different sort of realm. But you know what I mean? Most people who go out into the woods looking for Bigfoot don't end up seeing anything, you know.
No, unless they go on one of these group things, and then mysteriously in the middle of the night there's some kind of wood knocking that occurs, and then you find out that two members of the expedition had snuck away and done it themselves so they could get people to come back the next time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a lot of, luckily I haven't been roped in anything like that, but it's like, is that sort of a, I suppose people have to pay to go on one of these experiences, right? So it's sort of like the draw.
Yeah. It's what I call crypto tourism and crypto exploitation, where people are paying as much as $350 to go on these canned Bigfoot hunts.
That's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. But it's become a social network. You know, people don't go to ice cream socials at churches anymore. They go out Bigfoot hunting, and they expect to be entertained. There's usually some drinking going on, and there's lots of I'd say high-end electronic equipment being thrown around.
Yeah.
And so they expect something to, you know, a pair of eyes or a sound in the night or, you know, more than a coyote in the distance. And I'm not, you know, almost everybody I know is really reputable, but I have heard about and heard firsthand of individuals going on some of these hunts where they find out that some of the individuals that are taking in the money are also producing results so that people will feel positively reinforced to do it again. Because people go back year after year.
Oh, God.
And it's a social event.
Yeah, I mean, you see that with these Bigfoot, you see that with these UFO conventions too. It's a different sort of whole, different animal, but it's the same psychological structure in a lot of ways, you know. They want to go back and, you know, see everybody they saw at last year's thing, so they're going to go and we're all going to meet again next year, that kind of thing. So,
The internet and Facebook is filled with people, you know, can I get my picture taken with Bob Kimmel? Can I, things like that. It's real. There's a celebrity group of individuals. I mean, the Finding Bigfoot people, I like all of those individuals, and they're really good people, but they were just normal people. They got on TV and they're all now celebrities, and so they can go around the country, and it's kind of like lobbyists from Republican or Democratic parties, where they can go around and give speeches and get $300,000. the Bigfoot field's not getting that kind of money, but you can certainly know that individuals that were on TV for a long, long time are doing fairly well and have become celebrities way beyond any kind of work that they've ever done in the field.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, and as I've told a lot of media people for, I started telling people this 20 years ago, there is no funding. There are no Tom Slicks or Tom Pages or you know, any of those individuals during the 70s who were funding some of these expeditions. The number one funder of Bigfoot excursions is actually TV programs.
Yeah.
So if you're hooked up with a TV program, you will make money, they will make money, and everybody's happy. And a lot of the audience doesn't realize that some of those executive producers on those programs are getting $250,000 for that show.
Oh, wow.
So it's a lot. And none of the researchers, you know, the basic researchers, none of us writers, none of us people that have been in for a long, long time, we're just barely able to keep ahead of our mortgages, let alone think we're going to get a new car or anything from doing any of this work. That was one of the things 20 years ago when, you know, just kind of, well, maybe it was 15 years ago, when the internet started, the big thing that any writer like myself or author would jump on the internet to talk to people, and they would find that so many people thought that we were interested in talking to our readers because we wanted to sell more books like we were millionaires. And that was such a joke. And yeah. I'm glad that at least the internet has matured to the place that people can enjoy talking to, you know, like the guy that does American Gods, Neil, you know, him, and not think that he's just trying to sell more books by talking to his fans.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because it's like only – well, maybe there are other fields, I don't know, but it seems like, especially in the paranormal, it's like, it seems like anyone who's trying to make a living or anything is immediately, like, vilified. Like, this is the only
right.
It's the only field out there. It's like people don't go after a musician and be like, hey, man, your band's only trying to make money. It's
right.
Like, yeah, obviously.
Yeah, no, I know. One of these producers come to me and they say, you know, we want you to, you know, don't you want to help us put this thing on and do this Bigfoot, because you've been in the field for 50 years. Isn't you get your passion from this? And I said, and how much are you being paid for this? And how much per hour are you getting? And you don't want to give me even a little bit for my time? You know, it's like you have to get in arguments with these people to justify yourself, and you feel like a piece of crap because you should get money, and they should too, you know, everybody.
Right.
Artists should get money.
Exactly.
Writers should get money.
Yeah.
I mean, you should get money for this program, even though it doesn't cost anything, you know.
So, I agree.
Call it nine o'clock in the desert, you know.
There you go. Yeah.
There was once a great American named George Henderson. He met a woodland ape, or Sasquatch, and despite its dangerous message of environmentalism, became his friend. But when the time came to do the hard thing and send it back into the forest where it belonged, and birds could perch on its shoulder because it was gentle, George Henderson summoned the strength, and by God, he did it. Did it hurt? You bet it hurt. Like a bastard. But he did it because it was the right thing to do. For the woodland ape.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Is that Harry and the Hendersons?
You've seen it.
This is my life, Jack.